Barnes, registration number 10398, appearing this morning, this afternoon, on behalf of Mr. Casillas Sanchez. There are five issues raised in the brief. I've got a lot to get through, and I'd like to reserve whatever time I have remaining after this opening salvo for rebuttal. Mostly, I want to talk about issue one and issue two to the extent that I have a time to get to it. But before I do that, the court did have a question about issue four, the severance issue, and wanted us to focus on whether in the record this was preserved by a motion to renew the severance motion. I looked through my notes. I could not find a motion to renew the severance after trial began. And I talked to Mr. Carberry, the trial attorney, last week. He doesn't show that either, and his best recollection is he simply forgot. So we have a serious preservation issue with issue number four. It's going to be our position that despite the fact that this wasn't renewed, that it was preserved properly, it's such a fundamental error and such an irrational decision by the trial court in the first instance that it should amount to plain error. And I understand there's a problem with waiver versus plain error, but that's going to be our position. Mostly, I want to move on to issue numbers one and two, though. With issue number one, there's also a procedural issue raised by the prosecution, and I'll get to that momentarily. But to kind of take a running start at that with the history here, Mr. Casillas Sanchez was charged with murder around March of 2003, and Mr. Lozell was retained by his family to represent him at least by April 1st, 2003. Mr. Lozell was on the case for at least 17 months. During that time, there was preliminary hearing, there were various other motions hearings, there was an awful lot going on, and as the court may be aware from the briefs, the charges in this case snowballed somewhat. We went from the murder, and then we suddenly had the theft counts, and then we had additional drug counts, and then we had the intimidation of witness and weapon counts, and so on and so forth. So this case got bigger and bigger as time went on. At some point, Mr. Lozell contracted with Mr. Tom Carberry to come in and act as an independent counsel to help him with some motions hearings, not to run the trial, and they were not associates per se. We come to October of 2004, and there's a big hearing going on about similar transactions or 404B evidence, and there are a bundle of them in this case. There's something like 12 different domestic dispute issues, and then there's the drug things and everything else. But essentially what's happening at this hearing is this. The prosecution wants to introduce evidence of an arrest in October 2002 of Mr. Casillas Sanchez. It was an arrest for marijuana. They did a search. They found a small amount of heroin on him. The charges got bigger. They want to use that to show that Mr. Casillas Sanchez was a heroin user in, or possessing it at least, in 2002, and that this is one of the reasons why Ms. Archuleta wanted to leave him the following spring, because this was sort of the last straw in an ongoing problem she had with him using drugs. Well, not drugs, because they were both using cocaine and marijuana, but heroin, okay? And that was one of the many, many reasons why the prosecution said she wanted to leave him, was this heroin thing. Well, at this point, little bell goes off in Mr. Lozell's head and said, whoa, I represented him in that case, and the whole deal was he was a resident legal alien. And so I needed to get him a plea bargain where he would plead guilty to trespass to agricultural lands so he wouldn't get deported. Fine and well, but when I was doing that, I was having problems getting the records from him. I needed work records, TAC records, and so on, so that I could approach the DA, which they required to make this deal. And it was Ms. Archuleta who went out and gathered this stuff up for me and brought it to me, knowing what I was going to use it for, to help him avoid, to help him get the plea bargain. So there may be a conflict. And I think she might have been the person who paid me. I have to check my records. So you, prosecutor, might not want to go there with this transaction, because it's going to be a big problem. Well, prosecution wanted to go there, and so the cold case is turned over to November, and they have a further hearing on this. In November, Mr. Lozell comes in and says, okay, I checked my records. Near as I can tell, she did not pay me. It was his family or him, and it was in cash. She had nothing to do with that. But she did definitely help get these records for me, and she knew this was to avoid deportation ultimately. At this point, the judge says, that's enough. I find there's a conflict. That is something that you cannot testify to in front of the jury. It's just too important. And so the judge ruled there was a conflict. The next hearing was, they tried to reschedule another hearing for December, in which the question would be, Is this a conflict that Mr. Casillas-Sanchez can waive, or is it something so fundamental that he can't have Lozo at all?
What was the, during this whole series of hearings, what was the prosecution's position, if any, as stated before the court on the...
My recollection is that they thought that he should be gone, that this is important, and they really wanted this evidence in showing the heroin activity, and it was just really, really important. And what Lozal knew about this, what he could testify to about this, her helping him, they thought just made him a witness that they just didn't want him being both an attorney and a witness on that issue.
Was there actually a motion for disqualification?
I believe it was the judge who actually raised the issue himself.
Thank you.
I could be mistaken about that. I think the prosecution suggested there could be an issue here, but it was the judge who finally said, whoa, stop. Okay, so the next hearing is to determine, can this be waived or not? And then we have an order from a judge dated December 27th, which says, it's moot, because Mr. Casillas has clearly indicated he's not willing to waive it. So it's not going to be waived. There's a conflict. Mr. Lozo's off the case. All right. Now, what happened is there is a hearing, apparently, on this reference in that order that happened around December 16th that doesn't appear in our minute orders or our copy of it. We designated the record. We didn't catch that. We didn't designate it. It doesn't appear anywhere except in the reference in this order. As far as I can tell, as far as what it was scheduled for, what happened before and what happened after, it was simply a question to Mr. Casillas-Sanchez, are you willing to waive the conflict or not? Well, there's no dispute about that. He wasn't. But the prosecution on appeal is saying, we have this missing record here, so gosh, what might have happened there? We don't know. And it's a problem. And, the response to that is that 10B does require us to designate a record in advance and to list all the dates and all the reporters and everything from the minute orders, in which we did that. If the prosecution isn't happy with that, they think there's some other proceeding somewhere out there that might have some bearing on this some way, then it also provides they have the obligation and the right, but the obligation to move to supplement the record themselves with that hearing. Well, they haven't done that. So I don't think that this December 16th hearing has anything to do with the fundamental issue of was there a conflict or not, which had already been decided and ruled on by the judge in November. And to the extent they think it points otherwise, I don't know, we don't even know if Lozal was testifying at the hearing, so there's just no basis for it. With that out of the way, moving on to the merits of the claim, what we have is this, that everyone agrees Rule 3.7 governs whether there should be a withdrawal or conflict or not. And 3.7 basically states that, and to quote it, A, a lawyer shall not act as an advocate at trial in which the lawyer is likely to be a necessary witness except where, 1, the testimony relates to an uncontested issue. Our position is, and always has been, that the question of whether or not Ms. Archuleta helped Mr. Casillas-Sanchez with the gathering of these documents is not in fact contested. It never has been. There's not an iota of evidence that this is false or incorrect.
But counsel, you said it's not a fact that's contested. The question is whether it's an issue that's contested. And the issue is whether or not she wanted to have him stay in the U.S. because she wanted to continue to be with him together. Isn't that what the issue is?
It's not, because Mr. Lozal could not and did not testify to that issue. Mr. Lozal cannot get up at trial and says, she wanted him badly to stay in this country, and she loved him, and this was her motivation. He can't say that.
That's why he would give the testimony, would be to support that.
No. This is what I'm trying to get at, and this is very important. He can say, she helped cooperate in keeping him here. Her motivation for doing that is the issue, not whether she did it. Her motivation for doing it. Did she do it because she was in love with him? Did she do it because she wanted to marry him? Did she do it because she didn't want the financial problems? Did she do it because she wanted to do this for his family, which she liked? Did she do this because she was told to? Why she did it goes to the issue of motivation and whether she was leaving him or not. The fact she did it is not contested. Mr. Lozal cannot get up there and testify to the jury, and never did and never could, well, here's why she did it. Because that would be speculative. That would be That would be improper testimony. All he can say is, she did.
Well, was that argument though made? I mean, did some lawyer representing the defendant use those facts and testify as to the inferences that would lead you to conclude that her motivation was one way or the other? And isn't that what he would have had to do if he remained in the case and testified as to the
facts? Well, Your Honor, his offer of proof, the initial one he came up with, was just what the facts were. His initial offer of proof was not that she was in love with him or this or anything else. So I think that is easily implicit in his initial statement of what happened.
Why did the defense offer that testimony?
The defense wanted to offer the testimony so that the jury could look at that testimony together with all the other evidence in the case and draw an inference that, you know, she was not so hot to get rid of him. So, yes, ultimately, that is the issue, but that is not the fact to which he is testifying. In this regard, this is no different than chain of custody. You know, yes, this person had this at this time. They did this at this time. What does that mean? Does it mean it was the murder weapon? Well, maybe, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a fact, and the fact is not disputed.
And the rule talks about an issue, right?
Yeah, and since it does not involve a disputed, since it does not relate to a contested issue, it only relates to an uncontested fact, there's no grounds for disqualification. And if you say, well, if there's an issue that it somehow relates to, there's got to be disqualification, then everybody has to be disqualified in every instance, because in every single instance, that evidence isn't coming in unless it's relevant, period. And if it's not relevant to something, then it must be because the matter's, you know, it's not in the case. So if you read this the way the prosecution would have you do it, paragraph 1A is superfluous. I have one important thing I want to try to drive home about number three, where it would work a substantial hardship on the client. You know, this is like a 23-day trial, and you're talking about one guy, one defense attorney, being double-teamed from day one through this trial by two prosecutors. And, you know, Mr. Carberry did a pretty good job. And yet, here I am standing here today saying, oops, we forgot to renew the motion for severance. You know, this guy had to organize all these experts, contact them, people he had not contacted originally, prepare for the examination and of umpteen parades of these theft witnesses, of the drug people, of the similar transactions. It was a Herculean job. And he's on it by himself because he's hired by the family doing his best. The prosecution has him double-teamed the whole way. So it's an enormous hardship. And in addition, he was not on the case from day one. He was not the person lining up the experts of his choice. He didn't get to pick people he had rapport with. And that leads to issue two, which is where we get into this big battle between Snyder and Bevel. You know, if you ever want to read an interesting transcript, I know that you're pressed for time, but this, in my 25 years of doing this job, I have never come across a more furiously fought forensic case than what went on here between Bevel and Snyder. It was amazing. And the problem is, they interviewed Snyder without telling Carberry, and then he finds out during the trial, he goes, what's going on here? You've got statements from my expert you never told me about. And initially he makes the motion, you know, this is a problem. The judge says, it's kind of hard to determine when the judge says there's no violation or it's not prejudicial. But then Farnham, I think, comes in a rebuttal and says, well, guess what? Mr. Snyder confessed your whole case to me. He said he agrees with Bevel that her position, her posture was where Bevel says it was when she was shot. Therefore, you guys guilty. End of story. Whoa, where did that come from? Where it comes from, apparently, that the defense manages to establish witnesses and witnesses later, is her interpretation of the word position, okay? Because Snyder agreed with the position where this woman was shot, but he was referring to location, not posture, okay? It takes forever for the defense to get this fact out, but in the meantime, it looks like for a while the defense just is just blowing hot air, okay? Now, this should have been disclosed, and it wasn't, and it was extremely prejudicial. And there was a motion for mistrial, and apparently the prosecution's comeback on this one is, well, they didn't move to exclude the testimony, they could have moved for lesser sanctions. You know, well, that's subsumed in a motion for mistrial. It's up to the court to decide, if I'm not getting a mistrial, what do I think would be adequate? And I don't think there's any case that says the defense has to go through an entire laundry list, you know, once they've made the big motion for mistrial, of every single possible way that the judge could try to ameliorate the harm. That's not required of us, never has been.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Your time's up.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. John First for the people, registration number 16862. I too reviewed my notes in answer to the court's question about severance. And my notes disclosed that Mr. Carberry did a better job than maybe counsel here thinks, because at volume 25, pages 6 and 17, we raised the issue of severance. And that was actually after it was appropriate, because the prosecution had presented some witnesses, some theft witnesses, and that's the time when the motion is supposed to be re-raised at trial, so that, which is why I didn't make an issue of that in my brief, because there was no issue to be made.
So is your issue then that we should address the merits of that contention?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Which is why I did, yes.
Thank you very much.
With regard to disqualification, I think that really is the issue here. Now, of course, disqualification of counsel of choice is a serious matter. And the trial court here took it seriously. And it's also a matter within the broad discretion of the trial court. And here, the law and the record supports the trial court's ultimate ruling that Mr. Lozo should be disqualified. I mean, there is no argument here that Mr. Lozo was a necessary witness. He was the only one that could testify concerning the circumstances surrounding the victim's assistance to Mr. Lozo in that prior drug case, which, by the way, isn't the admission of that isn't being contested here on appeal. Judge Loeb, you asked a question: the prosecution's position was, as you noted, prosecution never moved to disqualify Mr. Lozo, nor did the prosecution subpoena him as a witness. Mr. Lozo brought this up at the September 2004 motions hearing, and which is the time at which counsel is or should be aware is, of course, an issue as to hardship. However, the prosecution, as to that, the prosecution filed its 404B motion back in April of 2004, listing that case. It's our position that that's the time that Mr. Lozo was, or at least should have been, aware that this was going to be an issue, but he doesn't raise it until 5 months later at the motions hearing. And it was Mr. Lozo who raised the issue. He brought it up, not the court. Mr. Lozo said, there could be an issue here. I need to look into it. And it progressed from there. So, Rule 3.7, counsel referred to it as a conflict rule. It's nothing of the sort. It's a prohibition against counsel testifying if he's likely to be a necessary witness, unless one of the exceptions apply. There's nothing in the rule, nothing in the comments that this is a waivable. The court, in an abundance of caution, did go through a waiver analysis, and that's fine, but that's not really relevant to the analysis of the issue. And it wouldn't be, because it was, if it is a conflict, it's an actual conflict anyway. Because Mr. Lozo, it's putting his credibility there in front of the jury, and that's what that's the whole purpose behind the rule, is the lawyer does not do that. Because it diminishes his effectiveness, both as an advocate and a witness. So it's a given that I think that he was a necessary witness. So the issue really comes down to, was it a contested issue? Now, defense wants to cherry pick these facts and give a partial view of what's going on. And these cherry picked facts are facts that arguably may be undisputed. I mean, that Mr. Loza represented the defendant. Sure. Of course, he did, early on, Mr. Loza indicated that the victim had paid him, but then he, at a later hearing, he kind of backed off that and said, well, I think maybe the defendant that did that. So even he wasn't clear. So is that contested? Maybe. The defendant was not a citizen? Well, that's arguably uncontestable. I think the prosecution conceded that he, they weren't contesting legal status. That he was convicted of that he wasn't convicted of a drug offense. I think it's pretty clear. However, and the only objection that the prosecution had during this whole proceeding, the prosecution never sided with the trial court. Never said, "Well, we think that he should be disqualified." The only thing the only position the prosecution took was that they won't stipulate. And how can they? Because I mean, you're stipulating to essentially what her motivations were in helping him. And, you know, I mean, how did he know that? Do we have to rely on his, because at trial he did testify that she wanted to help him. He says that she wanted him to stay in the country and did everything she could from preventing him from being deported. Now, I mean, that raises the obvious question. How did Mr. Loza know that? Did you tell him that? I mean, body language? How do we know? We don't. And that's what the prosecution properly didn't stipulate to. I mean, for all we know, she helped him because she was afraid of the consequences, adverse consequences, if she didn't help him. And there's plenty of testimony in the record that he, over that three-year relationship, that he was very controlling, physically so as well as psychologically. So it's just clearly not an uncontested issue, not a matter of formality. We're not talking about an attestation of a document, watching somebody execute a paper. I mean, that's clearly not what this is. It's really not. Counsel likens it to chain of custody. I don't think so. And central, Judge Miller, this was central to the case, what her motivation was. Because the case was, was it murder, was it suicide? So the status, status of their relationship at the time was key and crucial, and certainly not a matter of formality. Was it a hardship? Well, it never claimed it was a financial hardship, and this court can read the record for itself, and Mr. Carberry did a fine job at trial. And the record does indicate that at one point in pretrial, Mr. Grimaldi was also part of the defense team. There's an entry of appearance in the record, and there's at least one of the pretrial hearings that shows that Mr. Grimaldi was present. So they had the wherewithal to hire counsel before if Mr. Carberry had wanted it. I mean, there's no issue as to, they never raised the issue that, he was solo at trial and that was an undue hardship. So that's just not before this court either. And with regard to the work product, what was the trial court supposed to do here? Prosecution regarded it as statements as a work product, and there's an argument for that. I mean, these were prepared in preparation for cross-examination of Mr. Snyder. Now, record, there is an indication that, and this was from the July 26, 2005 hearing, that there's a, they typed them up and collaborated on, so it looks like that DA's investigator, Ms. Farnham, and Mr. Sargent worked together to try to recreate what Mr. Snyder said during his phone interview in order to prepare for cross-examination. I mean, that's, work product, maybe, maybe not. I mean, to the extent that you can parse out the what were truly witness statements versus prosecutor's mental processes. Well, you know, maybe that's what an in-camera hearing's for. But certainly arguable that that the rule, that portion of the Rule 16 discovery rules, that any reports or statements of experts made in connection with the case, including examined test results, didn't apply here. And I will draw the analogy to the witness statements in connection with police reports. I mean, we've got the first provision, police arrest, crime, or offense reports, including statements of all witnesses. Well, people in People v. District Court, court said that these witness statements, I mean, you could read that statement just as broadly, says it, including statements of all witnesses. But Supreme Court said those are witness statements in or associated with police reports, arrest reports, crime reports, or offense reports. Well, I think the same is, that's a reasonable interpretation of the provision at issue here, any reports or statements of experts made in or connection with the case. So, statements made in reports in connection with the case, in connection with the prosecution's case. I mean, that whole first A, part A of Rule 16 has to do with evidence that the prosecution is putting on. They weren't presenting these statements in that they took from this phone interview in their case in chief. These were there in case they needed them in impeachment or rebuttal, which is how they used them. So it was a reasonable interpretation, and I think, I dare say, I think all prosecutors read it that way too, is that those statements included therein are statements of their own witnesses that they disclose, just like they have to disclose the offense reports. If you take a look, it's a laundry list. Any books, papers, documents, photographs, or tangible objects held as evidence in connection with the case. Tapes, transcripts, electronic surveillance of conversations involving the accused. This is evidence that the prosecution has.
What was the court's ruling here? Did the court rule that there wasn't a violation, or did the court rule that even if there was no, he could cure it by having him turn the notes over and allowing the defense to come back and inquire about him the next day? I mean, what was the actual ruling, or is it clear?
I'm not sure it's that clear. I mean, the court did fine, as you can see from its ruling, that counsel made reasonable arguments on both sides. It's our position that fact alone, you know, it was a proper exercise of the court's discretion to deal with the situation. I mean, it's within the court's discretion to direct discovery anyway. And so what the court did is, okay, once you use them to impeach prosecution under People v. Small, you've got to disclose. Prosecution said, you bet.
And I take it the context in which the issue is before us is the motion for mistrial.
That's correct.
Okay.
At that point, not only that, they gave the defense had the notes for the afternoon, because the trial court recessed for that afternoon, gave the defense plenty of opportunity to review the notes, and they came back on redirect and rehabilitated the witness. Witness said, among other things, yeah, I mean, I still couldn't remember, though, which is interesting. Even after an afternoon and an evening with these notes, still couldn't remember what he had said during the conversation. So they would have come in anyway as inconsistent statements.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that Mr. Snyder advised either Mr. Carberry or Mr. Lozo that he'd had that conversation?
I don't believe there. I don't recall anything in the record. It's probably unlikely, since he couldn't remember the statements, you know, once presented with him. So I suspect not, but I can't say for sure. But But on redirect, he said, yeah, I mean, I didn't have a lot of evidence. That's why, you know, I would have made those statements. So there's no prejudice here. And unless the court has any other questions, I just ask that you affirm the convictions and the sentence.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. First. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. That does complete the court's docket for this afternoon.